Hello, I'm Keith Perron. Welcome to Focus Asia Pacific from PCJ Radio International. Men detained by Australia on Manus Island say they have requested asylum from New Zealand as it's not safe to settle in Papua New Guinea. Displaced by war and discrimination, the refugees now say they face destitution on the streets of PNG. Ben Robinson-Drawbridge reports.
140 detainees sent a letter to the New Zealand Prime Minister Bill English this week pleading for rescue. Iranian asylum seeker Benham Sata was the first to sign the petition.
We have been detained almost 4 years in very bad condition and situation. So we are requesting the Right Honourable Bill English to allow us to go to New Zealand and process our claims and save us from these harsh conditions that we are going through.
With the imminent closure of the Manus Detention Centre, its 800-odd detainees will be repatriated, deported, settled in the US or in PNG. Mr. Sata says violent conflict with locals and two attacks on the detention centre deterred detainees from processing their refugee claims in PNG, where they felt it was not safe to stay.
The reason they gave us negative status was because many of us refused to process our claims. We never felt safe in this country. As you know, we have been attacked a couple times. While we have been here, we have always heard about New Zealand who supports and respects refugees. We promise to contribute to the New Zealand community and to all New Zealand people.
Australia declined a previous offer from New Zealand to take some of its offshore detainees, but Amnesty International's Grant Baildon says the offer should be redirected to PNG.
New Zealand has offered to take up to 150 from Australia, from its offshore centres, but it seems that the Australian government isn't going to do the right thing anytime soon, and really it's time now where the New Zealand government needs to make that offer to the PNG government and to Nauru as well.
The PNG Immigration Minister, Rimbink Pato, would not confirm if his government would consider such an offer, although he implied last month that third country resettlement was Australia's domain.
Australia bears full responsibility for the asylum seekers. So long as the last person remains at the centre, so long as the last person cannot be resettled in the USA, resettled in a third country, or resettled in PNG, then obviously Australia will help us find a solution because it's Australia that we are seeking to help.
But Grant Baildon says it's up to PNG to sort out Australia's mess.
The Australian government has said that any deal would need to be between New Zealand and PNG or Nauru. The PNG government clearly has a problem on its hands. It's not viable to resettle them there. The Australian government bears the primary responsibility to bring them back to Australia. But of course, if they don't do the right thing, then other countries in the region, including New Zealand, should do the right thing.
The gradual closure of the Manus Island Detention Centre has begun, and the centre is due to be empty by October the 31st. This is Ben Robinson-Drawbridge.
A former media advisor to the Tongan Prime Minister is now calling for him to resign. Kalafi Morole operates the Tamilo Tonga newspaper, the latest issue of which leads with the article asking the Prime Minister to step down, accusing him of incompetence. He told Koro Wakawata, "The last straw was when the Prime Minister withdrew from the Pacific Games hosting on what he calls outdated information."
That's just the latest. I mean, we go back to a series of things. For example, his declaration of war against the media, particularly the public media, the government-owned media, Tonga Broadcasting Commission. The CEO have been dismissed. Her contract was not renewed. Two board members over a period of, the last year and a half have been dismissed. All of this was done. They have contracts, they have legislations that guard the Broadcasting Commission. And the basis of all of that was that he believes that the Tonga Broadcasting Commission was not supporting his government. While that's still unresolved and there's a lot of public discussion of that, he moves on and cancelled the games. Prior to that, there was all kinds of situations, like he's building a park in a poor area, and there's a lot of questions. A park? There was never part of the government plan to build a park. Then he declares that he's going to build a golf course right next door to the park. And in the process of building this golf course, he's going to end up destroying some of the key heritage sites in Tonga. These are sites that we call Sia Alupe, very significant in our history, and he's going to destroy all of that for the sake of building a golf course. There's a whole bunch of things, the way he dealt with education, but essentially it's decisions that are made with no reasons, or at least the reasons were given were based on false assumptions.
Are the people on the ground, do they have the same dissatisfaction, or is it not really something that they're even bothering with?
There is a huge growing dissatisfaction. At the beginning, I think most people knew that the Prime Minister was going to undergo huge changes to his own mindset and his own way of doing things. Remember, he was for about 30 years in the opposition. He basically was Tonga's chief critic about the system of Tonga, about the culture, a whole number of things. And he was calling for reform. So there was a lot of hope in a lot of people where they thought maybe when this guy and this government comes in, we're going to see the kind of reforms that we need in Tonga. But when this government came into being, we have seen just the opposite. We're not more democratic now than we've been. A lot of decisions that are made that are more dictatorial. We're seeing a very high level of incompetence. And I think with all due respect to Mr. Pohiva himself, he did well as an opposition leader. There were a lot of national issues that he raised. But then when you give him the reins of government, I think he's having a difficult time. The cabinet itself, they're not together. They're not one. They're not in unity. He's had ministers which he has dismissed or replaced. More and more people are asking a lot of questions and they're not getting the answers.
You've been close to Mr. Pohiva in the past. You've worked beside him, for him. Is it shocking what's happened?
Yes, it is shocking, because what Pohiva brought to Tonga was hope. Many of us who have grown up in Tonga, we have seen some of the inconsistencies in the way power have dealt with the people of Tonga. There are a lot of questions that we have. Is this just? The people in power at the time were actually saying, well, we're going to bring some changes, particularly from the royal family. There was indication, yes, we've got to move with the times and there will need to be some changes. Now, all through this time, Pohiva has been a very strong voice that Tonga must undergo reform to make Tonga be more democratic, that there needs to be better sharing of resources, equality, and so on. And for many of us who wanted to see reform, we all came around Pohiva and got on the train, so to speak. But as the years went by, it was again on hope. And then, of course, when he became the prime minister, got into government, our hope was just so high. There were many things that was promised. One was good governance. There's going to be transparency. There's going to be accountability, fair and just sharing of resources. We're going to focus on trying to reduce poverty, making services a lot more affordable. A whole bunch of things listed, because I was quite involved with them in the campaign of 2014 to bring them in power. Then when the government came into being, Mr. Pohiva became the prime minister. Everything we had hoped for, everything that he had promised, and I mean everything, I couldn't check any of those lists that it has been taken care of.
Do you regret now your part in that lead up to the 2014 election?
No, I don't. Because 2014, what would have been the alternative? And whenever you do something out of hope, you have to give hope a chance. Some of us who have been close to Mr. Pohiva for many, many years, we knew some of his weaknesses. But we thought, well, at least if we can get into the door, maybe there's hope. For the first few months, I was his media advisor, and my hope was eroded. And not only my hope, I found that a lot of hope of people who were supporters, who were pushing for this. The push was not because Pohiva was the savior. It was because we wanted Tonga to move to something better.
Calling for resignation. What do you want to achieve by this, you know, having this published now?
We feel as media to provide a voice. And there is a voice there that's provided through this report of our newspaper of many, many people that feel that he should be out, that he needs to have somebody else lead the country that is more competent. I mean, if you're going to have a politician, you better have a politician you can trust. That's not our experience with him. We feel that we are to provide a voice for the voiceless, those people that are calling for him to be replaced. And I think he will be remembered for some of the work that he has done before as an opposition leader. But if he continues to do what he's doing, he will go down as probably the worst prime minister we have ever had.
The Pacific Games Council is giving the Tongan government 1 month to address its financial concerns over hosting the 2019 Games. The council's executive board met last Friday to address the government letter withdrawing their support for hosting the event. CEO of the Pacific Games Council, Andrew Minogue, told Vinnie Wiley, they resolved to make one last attempt to keep the 2019 Games in Tonga.
We agreed as a board to provide a short window of opportunity of basically 1 month until the end of June for the Tongan government to come back to the table, negotiate with the Games Council around the cost concerns that they have in relation to the Games. At that point, we make a decision to all parties to remain in Tonga. If that doesn't happen by the end of June, then we start putting expressions of interest out to other countries who may wish to host the Games in 2019.
So from the Pacific Games Council's point of view, you still very much believe Tonga is well positioned to host these Games and can indeed host these Games?
That's correct. If the government resumes its support for the Games as it had been doing up until a couple of weeks ago, the council is confident that Tonga can deliver the event. The organising committee's been up and running for several years and it's doing its work. The venues are coming together with the help of donor governments, particularly the Chinese and also New Zealand and Australia, the main stadium. So we're confident that the facilities will be in place. The government has the financial resources to make contributions where necessary with the venues, but also with the operational costs of the Games. And as I said, if that support resumes, as it has been there for the last sort of 4.5 years, then we remain confident that Tonga can deliver the event.
And so the council is seeking a meeting with the Prime Minister and the Cabinet to go over, I guess, the intricacies and the detail.
That's right. Early next week, we're available to be in Tonga to meet with the Prime Minister and the Cabinet and to start a process where we would be able to give them some comfort on minimising or reducing the costs of delivering the Games. And we've got some expertise that we can bring in to help do that. So the offer is there. If that's what the government feels the costs need to be brought down, we can look at ways of doing that.
Have you received any indications from other countries, just informally, that there are obviously options there, or there are people that would be willing to, I guess, take on the mantle if it got to that point?
Yes, and I think you would have seen press reporting from one or two of the other countries in the Pacific that would be interested in hosting the Games. I actually don't want to say too much more than that at this stage because our focus is on Tonga. They were awarded the Games. They've done a lot of work to start preparing for them. We've made it very clear that by the end of June, if we're not resolving the situation there, we are moving on. But for this upcoming month, we want the focus to remain very much on Tonga.
The floating island plan for French Polynesia is a chance to tackle global warming without politicians. That's according to scholars working on the project. Natalie Mazu-Garcia is researching the project, which will involve a self-contained community on man-made structures off Tahiti. It's a joint project between the Silicon Valley-based Stiseti Institute and the French Polynesian government. She told Sally Round the planned city is an experiment in how the community can organize itself without central control.
The thing is that for you to be accepted as a nation in the international arena, you have to be recognized by other nations. That's why there are territories that are in dispute internationally and that they don't have the independence of a nation because they are not recognized as such. But in this case, the French Polynesian government is accepting the think tank, Sisteri in Blue Frontiers, to develop a sister here in the international waters, which makes it really interesting because it means that you don't need to oppose necessarily a nation state, that you can actually make partnerships with them and benefit both. This is one of the things that I find the most interesting.
How can a community like this run seemingly without any rules? Would there be rules? Would there be leadership?
No leadership. But there are a few ways of looking at it. One way is for rules to be decided depending on the ownership of the sister. So let's say you can be the owner of a platform, And in your platform, you can have several houses. So it can be that you decide the rules, or it can be that you create a platform and you say, okay, I sold you the platforms, I build them, you buy them, you manage them however you want. So it really depends on how the people itself who move there want to manage it. But definitely no leadership, because then there would not be any difference with how we have traditionally been organizing ourselves.
It's hard not to think that a community like this could either descend into chaos or oppression.
I don't think it's going to happen with this one. The advantage that we have, and by we, I mean people who are studying the subject, is that we have the opportunity to set up which are the new rules of the game. I like a lot the example of behavioral economics, the decision that hotels made to force people in a very undercover way to have to save energy. Because whenever people stayed in a hotel, it wasn't their house, they didn't care about the electricity bills, so they left the hotel rooms and let the lights on. So the measurement that hotels did, and these similar things can be done in this floating city to make rules that are there but are not evident. So we have an advantage now, this type of new human communities, of create better rules than the ones we massively exported, especially after the Industrial Revolution. And one of the reasons why I find this project and the ones that will come afterwards so fascinating is because it allows to change for the first time in a peaceful way the structure of governance. And this is something that, despite that it can have its problems, it's really marvelous. And that's why I'm putting my energy to trying to make it as most harmonic as possible.
You said there were other communities like this, but do you think this is groundbreaking in a different way?
This is groundbreaking in the partnership with the French government. There's a micronation called Sealand near England. It has not gained the recognition of a nation, but people live there. They were once hosting pirate-based service, but they were not taken seriously. The French Polynesian government is being so cooperative that it makes me think that definitely Blue Frontier is taking seriously all the environmental impact assessment reports that they are doing, because it is a wonderful opportunity both for tackling global climate problems and also to creating better architectures of governance.
Nearly 150 whale teeth have been handed over to Fiji's Prime Minister by the New Zealand Department of Conservation staff at a cultural ceremony in Fiji. The teeth are a highly regarded cultural gift in Fiji and have been seized at New Zealand's border over the last 15 years under the Trade in Endangered Species Act. Indira Stewart has more.
A karakia blessing by the Department of Conservation's Kahui Kaupapa Atawhai team to release the 146 whale's teeth before they are repatriated to Fiji. Docs Joe Harawira says it's great the items are finally being returned.
We understand that these are very valuable to the people of the land. And so it's our responsibility to be able to return these tambua back to Fiji.
Known in Fiji as tambua, the tooth of a sperm whale is made into a necklace, gifted as a cultural heirloom, and passed down in families through generations. Dali Jobson declared her 13-centimetre-long tambua at customs in January when she returned from a trip to Fiji. The tambua was gifted to her 9-year-old daughter by village elders in a formal ceremony, and the family were devastated when it was confiscated at the border. She says she's pleased to hear about the repatriation and hopes those who've had them seized may be able to collect them in Fiji.
I'm relieved and really grateful. Also, just pleased that they recognise the cultural significance of the tambua, and having it repatriated back to home is comforting for me. As a Fijian living away from Fiji, that these things are protected and kept safe.
It's not commonly known, but an export permit is needed to take Tambua overseas because it's one of 34,000 species covered by the Convention on International Trade in Endangered Species, or CITES. More than 90% of specimens seized at New Zealand's border under CITES are destroyed. But since the early 1990s, after a request from Fiji authorities, all Tambua have instead been collected and stored by DOC. Wendy Jackson is the head of New Zealand CITES Authority and says the repatriation is the first of its kind for DOC.
We're pleased that we're able to do this, and it's such a better outcome, I think, for conservation, I think for public awareness, for understanding the relationship between, you know, people, culture, nature. I just think it's fantastic. Yeah, it fits with what DOC's about.
John Scanlon is the Secretary General of the International Convention based in Geneva and will be attending the repatriation ceremony. Mr. Scanlon says repatriations under the convention are rare and the cultural significance of today's event is huge.
It's an extraordinary event because it's blending culture with people, with wildlife in a way we don't often see. At the same time, we've seen that the repatriation was necessary because people were crossing international borders with Tambua without getting the necessary permits. So it also gives us an opportunity to raise some awareness.
The repatriation ceremony will kick off a week-long regional workshop attended by delegates from around the South Pacific to raise awareness of CITES and improve implementation of the convention around the region. This is Indira Stewart.
When delegates sit down next week in New York to consider how to ensure sustainability of the world's oceans, there will be a strong Pacific push to focus on the rights of coastal communities. The United Nations Oceans Conference, which is being co-hosted by Fiji and Sweden, with a specific focus on Sustainable Development Goal 14, namely to conserve the sustainable management and the use of oceans, seas, and marine resources. Hugh Govan is an advisor with the locally managed Marine Area Network and has worked with coastal communities for many years. He told Don Wiseman traditional Pacific communities have a lot to contribute to the world's understanding of how to manage the ocean sustainably and how they should be listened to.
The Pacific Islands have many, many hundreds, if not thousands of years of experience in living with their coastal resources, indeed their oceanic resources. And in the run-up to this conference focused on the ocean, it seems appropriate that the experiences of the Pacific Islands should receive a lot of prominence, given that they are kind of stewards of the world's biggest ocean and have huge amounts of experience for a very small population comparatively to other countries. What I'm in a good position to say now, after 17 years working with this network and 30 years working with Pacific Island communities, there is much the Pacific Islands and the communities in particular have to offer the world in terms of showing ways forward where people can be actively part of, you know, managing the coastal and indeed the oceanic resources. I think this is something that the world should be pricking its ears up to.
So in that time that you've been involved with these coastal communities around the Pacific, how much harder has it become for them to feed themselves from fish, with fish?
Yeah, I think it's fair to say, particularly in Melanesia, the more populated countries, that it has become considerably harder. This is partly to do with the large increase in population in these countries, but also the increased access to markets, which of course, would be able to provide much-needed cash for these remote communities. And so certain species, particularly the valuable ones, are critically overfished. Some of them, like the bechtemer, the most valuable of the coastal species, is actually closed. The fisheries closed in most of the countries in the Pacific just can't handle the pressure.
So in terms of management, what is it that you think needs to happen to ensure that these people are able to feed themselves for a long time to come?
Well, for feeding purposes, in other words, for food, the coastal communities are able to manage their resources following more or less the same traditions as they always have. That is based on their rights to be able to determine what happens inside those coastal areas. So those are sort of customary fishing rights. In other words, the communities are able to exclude industrial fishing or foreign fishers from the coastal areas on the basis of those rights. That gives them a very strong ability to decide what happens there. Securing or keeping those rights would probably be enough for food purposes. But if you're trying to feed urban populations or let alone export fish overseas, then you end up with a much more dollar-oriented or commercial pressure. And that one isn't quite so easy to handle because there you have the local needs for money, which can only really be provided from a small variety of sources, competing against wise long-term management.
The Oceans Conference is going to consider this ocean policy framework, and you've been involved with preparing Fiji's part of this.
Yeah, Fiji has spent a lot of this year drafting an ocean policy framework, essentially consulting all the stakeholders, whether in government, private sector, or civil society. And this will be one of the more widely consulted ocean policies that Fiji's produced ever. And hopefully would also be able to show the world that involving the main stakeholders is the best way forward. From the civil society point of view, of course, a lot of the inputs have been around the work of coastal communities and what they need to be able to manage their resources better. And that, as I mentioned, revolves around ensuring that the basic rights to carry out their guardianship or stewardship are preserved or promoted.
Through the work you've been doing, and as you say, you've worked across the Pacific, but there are situations when you look at the world as a whole, it's far worse, isn't it, in terms of the access to fish that coastal communities and other places have, and there needs to be work there to protect them, and this is incorporated into the work that you and Fiji have been working on.
That's right. Well, the LMMA network facilitates exchanges between communities in the Pacific and elsewhere in the world. And from that perspective, we realize how fortunate the Pacific is. Also, how much it would be desirable for foreign governments in the rest of the world to acknowledge more rights to their coastal communities in Africa, South America, and so on, quite often have to deal with not only with their internal pressures, but also the depredations of industrial and commercial fleets. And without any legal basis to regulate their access to inshore waters, the communities will be basically put out of business and put out of their livelihoods. And the FAO and the Sustainable Development Goal 14, which this conference is about, do provide for the protection and recognition of coastal communities' rights. But it's certainly not a done deal. It seems to be an area that many governments are reluctant to accept in precisely the wording that was formulated under these goals, and we will be keeping a very close eye on whether these governments are on the side of communities or not.
And with that, well, we end this edition of Focus Asia Pacific. If you wish to contact us, our email address is focus@pcjmedia.com. We would also invite you to let us know how you heard this program, if it was off satellite, AM, FM, or on shortwave. We'd really love to know. And of course, if you do listen on shortwave, we will send you the Focus Asia Pacific QSL card. Our email address, of course, is focus@pcjmedia.com. On behalf of the whole team, I'm Keith Powell, wishing you well, saying so long, take care. We'll see you again very soon. Bye-bye.